All right, we're going to be in the seventh chapter of Daniel this evening. when Lowell asked me what VBSs I had available, I'd done Daniel with other VBSs in the past, and I mentioned to him I thought this might be a good fit for this particular congregation in light of the fact that at your two-week meeting coming up, Rick Sparks is going to take you through the book of Revelation. And the book of Daniel and the book of Revelation really are peas in a pod, if you will. Revelation is just an extension of the book of Daniel, and no more so than the seventh chapter of Daniel. So as we get into the seventh chapter of Daniel, we're really laying a foundation for some of the things that take place, particularly in Revelation 13 and following. So if you plan to participate in Rick's class this summer, this might be a good warm-up for you so you get familiar with what he's going to be talking about, probably, I would guess, in the second week or so, depending on how quickly he moves through the book. You notice in verse number 1 of chapter 7 that this vision took place in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. Belshazzar is the final ruler of Babylon prior to the fall of the city to the Medes and the Persians. We read about that in chapter 5. Chapter 5 is kind of an interesting chapter because you've got Belshazzar throwing this great feast and this great party. What the Bible doesn't tell us is that outside the city walls that night was the Babylonian army. They had stopped the river Euphrates. There was no water flowing into the city. And what ended up happening that evening is some of the priests opened up the gates down in the riverbed that would normally keep any invading army out. They opened those gates, and that's how the Medes and the Persians ended up taking the city. And that's going to become important in this seventh chapter because it's going to talk about how the Babylonian Empire was changed from a ferocious beast into sort of a benign empire. And Belshazzar has a role in that. In that feast that he throws, it's indicative of a man who's not taking his responsibilities as the king very seriously. So this vision is given in his first year. Daniel had a dream, he says in verse number 1, and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Whenever I teach this chapter, I always want to emphasize that final statement in verse number 1. We don't have the complete vision. He just gives us the main facts. There's a lot more to this that he saw, but he doesn't share that because the Holy Spirit did not move him to share it. He gives us basically what we need to know, albeit in some very heavily symbolic language that we've got to spend some time unlocking, and that's what we'll be spending our time doing this evening. So in Daniel chapter 7, beginning in verse 2, Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. The first was like a lion, and had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side, and had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back 4 wings of a bird. The beast also had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom the 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. I watched till thrones were put in place, and the Ancient of Days was seated. His garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head was like pure wool. His throne was like a fiery flame, its wheels a burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth before him. 1,000 thousands ministered to him, 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were open. I watched them because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. To him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom the one which shall not be destroyed. This is, in short, the series of visions that Daniel saw. Verses 2 through 14 record the vision, and then the rest of the chapter is just an explanation or an interpretation of what these things mean. And in particular, Daniel is curious about the fourth beast and this little horn that's speaking pompous words, and that's really what the interpretation centers around, is the identity of that little horn and explaining what that little horn is all about. So let's get into the vision here. Let's take a look at verses 2 and 3 to begin with. So we had the four winds of heaven. In the ancient world, this universally represented the four directions of the earth. In Jeremiah chapter 49, verse 36, God says, "Against Elam I will bring the four winds from the four quarters of heaven and scatter them toward all those winds. There shall be no nations where the outcasts of Elam will not go." So here we have the four winds, I guess you would say the winds of the entire earth, stirring up the great sea. The great sea represents a multitude of nations and peoples. And we can look at other passages in the Bible that corroborate this. One of the things I really want to emphasize this evening and the rest of this week is the Bible is filled with all sorts of poetic and figurative and symbolic language. And the Bible really is its own best dictionary. If we want to understand the language that God uses to reveal things, then we need to look to the source. As Joseph stood before Pharaoh, he testifies that the interpretation belongs to God. God gives the vision, and the interpretation belongs to Him. So if we want to understand symbolic languages, we need to look at the Bible and find those definitions. In figurative language in the Bible, the great sea or seas represent peoples or nations. And some have argued that this could be the Mediterranean Sea. That would have been the great sea that Daniel was familiar with, being originally from the land of Judah. He would have known the Mediterranean. Whether or not that's the case, I think, is up for speculation. What it is representative of, I'm sure, is that from the midst of this multitude, from the midst of this nation, come these four beasts. If you're interested in knowing where else to look for definitions or how that figurative language is defined, you could look at Isaiah 17, 12 and 13, and Revelation 17, 15. Both of those characterize nations or a multitude of nations as a great sea or as waters, peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. That's Isaiah 17, 12 and 13, and Revelation 17, 15. So here we have the winds stirring up the sea. We've got a time of unrest, of instability. We've got a lot of things going on. Commotion, upheaval among the nations of the world. And Daniel sees, coming out of the midst of this great sea, four beasts. And these each represent a kingdom. These are four kingdoms. And we know that based upon what's said later on in verse number 17. The angel who's standing by, who offers some commentary on Daniel's vision, says this: "Those great beasts, which are four kings or kingdoms, which arise out of the earth." Later on in verse 23, as he's talking about the fourth beast, he says, "The fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth." Now, this is not the first time in the book of Daniel we've seen four kingdoms represented. If you were here last evening, we talked about the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his dream at night. The image that was comprised of four different types of metal: gold, silver, bronze, and iron, and then it also had iron with ceramic clay mixed in at the feet. So we've already seen four kingdoms or four nations of the earth represented in the book, and that's the case here. This idea of a beast representing a kingdom is once again right out of God's dictionary of prophetic language, if you will. Over in the book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel was a contemporary of Daniel. He was in a different part of Babylon, but was in the Babylonian captivity. In Ezekiel 29, verse 3, God's talking about the Pharaoh of Egypt, and he says to Ezekiel, "Speak and say, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Pharaoh, king of Egypt, O great monster who lies in the midst of his rivers." There's the characterization of a ruler or of a kingdom as a great monster in the midst of a river. And of course, that brings to mind the idea of those big, are they crocodiles or are they alligators in the Nile? I can't remember. That, is it crocodiles? Okay. Been a while since I studied that stuff. But yeah, this great monster lying in the middle of the river, ready to consume whatever comes its way. So here we have, in these initial couple of verses, a time of great upheaval and commotion. And in the midst of all this upheaval and commotion, four kingdoms come from the midst of this multitude of nations. And I think we could conclude, based on the imagery that we see here, that these kingdoms are successive. They rise successively out of the sea. One is followed by another, which already is familiar to us based on what we know from the book of Daniel. So the question is, who are these four kingdoms? That's what we first need to answer. Who are these four great kingdoms? If you were here last night, you'll recall that in that image back in chapter 2, we also have four kingdoms: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, represented by those various metals. And I think that that's the case here as well, and I'll tell you why in the upcoming minutes. The conclusion in chapter 2, and the point that I emphasized toward the end of my lesson last night, was that in this succession of kingdoms, the ultimate message is that God triumphs over the kingdoms of this world. You have the stone that's cut out of the mountain without hands that strikes the image on its feet. It grinds the image into dust. And of course, that stone is representative of Jesus. That stone grows into a great mountain, which is representative of the people of God. And that great mountain fills the whole earth. The kingdom of God is everywhere on the earth. That's the main message of chapter 2. And we're going to see a similar message here. As we read down through verses 11 through 14, you notice that ultimately this ends with the day of judgment. And when we get down to that section a little later, I'll tell you why I believe what we have in verses 11 through 14 represent the day of judgment. I think that there are some key phrases that we see in other parts of the Bible that would lead us to believe that this is the final judgment, the final outpouring of God's wrath upon the nations of this world, His vengeance upon those who have oppressed and persecuted His people, handing them what is their just due. So the message in chapter 2 is God triumphs. The message in chapter 7 is God triumphs. And the message in Revelation is Jesus wins. That's really the message of both books. In the midst of turmoil and persecution and great tribulation, the people of God can take consolation that God is concerned about their circumstances, that He will avenge what has been done against them, and that their prayers do not fall upon deaf ears. Here we have, in this particular chapter, though, four successive kingdoms, and I believe these are the four same empires that we see in chapter 2. Now, some might wonder, well, why give two separate visions about the same subject? Well, I think what we see in chapter 7 is a little bit different of an angle than what we get in chapter 2. And God often operates in this way. He often gives us a little bit of information here and a little bit of information there and expects us to sort of put things together in order to figure it out. And this is a biblical principle. In the book of Isaiah, chapter 28, verse number 10, God's talking about how He communicates to His people. And He says, "For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, here a little, there a little." He's talking about building his message, if you will. He puts a little bit here and a little bit there. He places a precept here, places one there. And by that, he's building an overall piece of communication. And I think that's true in the book of Daniel. Chapter 2 sets the stage. Chapter 7 gives us a different angle, helps us to see some other things that are going on that aren't obvious in chapter 2. So we have a single coin, if you will, with two different sides. We're getting two different views. All right, let's push on to verse number 4. I will pause and ask for questions here in about 5 or 10 minutes. So if you've got them, hold them. We'll get to it in just a moment. If you'd like to think of one, please do that as well. All right, let's get into verse number 4. Just to review, let's read it. So the first beast is like a lion. It had eagle's wings. I watched till its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. All right. With each of these, I want to take just a little bit of time to talk about the symbolic language. I want it to be clear that I'm not just pulling these things out of the air. I want to develop some sort of connection between the language that God uses and the actual fulfillment of the prophecy. So let's talk just for a moment about the symbolism here. We've got a beast that's like a lion, and it has eagle's wings. Lions are the kings of the animal kingdom. Eagles are the kings of the birds. A lion with eagle's wings is exceedingly swift and strong. And to me, this insinuates a military might that projects power and conquers rapidly. Over in the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 1, verse 23, David is lamenting the death of his close friend Jonathan and Jonathan's father Saul, who had persecuted David a great deal. And in lamenting their death, he says this about them in 2 Samuel 1:23. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives. That's something to say. Saul was pleasant in his life. Boy, wasn't David gracious towards Saul? I'm getting a little off track, I realize. But isn't that a gracious statement? Continuing on. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. Notice we've got that pairing. Eagles and lions, swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. So if we've got a lion with eagle's wings, we've got a beast that is both strong and quick, swift. And I think of military power that can move quite quickly. But notice that in the course of time, its wings were plucked off, which means that that swiftness is taken away. It's unable to project that power, if you will. It's made to stand up on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Here we have this beast transformed from a fierce beast into sort of a weak or benign man. If I were to think of something fierce, I would think of a lion first and foremost, and not a man. Although I think we could make arguments they're fierce men too, but I hope you get what I mean by that. All right. When we look at the symbolic language of the Bible, this seems pretty consistent with what we know about Babylon. Now, I'm going to give you a whole lot of information on this particular part of the prophecy because I think it's essential that we establish who this kingdom really is, and we understand why it's represented as a lion with eagle's wings. In Jeremiah, who was the last prophet of the nation of Judah before captivity, he would have been long dead by this point. He would have been alive as Daniel and his three friends were taken to Babylon, still staying back there in Jerusalem, prophesying about what was coming. In Jeremiah chapter 4 verses 5 through 13, chapter 49 verse 19 and 22, and also chapter 50 verse 44. And in each of those passages, we have indication that Babylon was compared to both a lion and an eagle. It's compared to a lion in Jeremiah 49, in Jeremiah 50. And in Jeremiah 49:22, it's compared to an eagle. The passage, though, that I'd like to take just a moment to turn to is the book of Lamentations. Now, Lamentations is also written by Jeremiah. And it's written by Jeremiah after the fall of Jerusalem. I always imagine Jeremiah sort of walking around the ruins of the city of Jerusalem and just sort of mourning what's taken place. And in Lamentations chapter 4, verse 19, Jeremiah says, "Our pursuers," which would have been the Babylonians, "our pursuers were swifter than the eagles of heaven. They pursued us on the mountains and lay in wait for us in the wilderness." They were swifter than the eagles of heaven. They waited for us. They waited to capture us. Waited for us in the wilderness. To me, this just gives further confirmation that the beast that we're talking about, this beast that has a body like a lion but had eagle's wings, is representative of the nation of Babylon. And if you want to read about the destruction of Jerusalem, you can do so in 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 1 through 21, and you'll get a sense of just how ferocious Babylon was. They were terrible to the nation of Jerusalem. Now, this beast is transformed into a man. Now, this is kind of what happens to Nebuchadnezzar, although it happens in reverse, doesn't it? Initially, he goes from a man to a beast, and then goes from a beast to a man, right? So there's a little bit of literalness about this. But we also have some indication that the Babylonian Empire sort of softened up after Nebuchadnezzar. You might remember last night we were talking about why Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. And I mentioned last night that Nebuchadnezzar was the greatest of the Babylonian emperors, and everybody after that was just pretty poor. And the nation crumbled, the empire crumbled pretty quickly after his death. We get indication of this in a couple of different places. In 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 27 through 30, Jehoiachin, who is one of the Jerusalem kings, was shown compassion by the successor of Nebuchadnezzar, Evil-Merodach. Evil-Merodach comes to him, he gives him some food, and starts to speak really nice to him, and makes his stay a little bit easier. And that does give some sort of indication that the Babylonians were softening up. But I think the real testimony that we can turn to is in that fifth chapter of Daniel, which I mentioned a few minutes ago. There's Belshazzar in the city of Babylon throwing a party while he's got an invading army laying siege to his city. I mean, it's just, it's bizarre. It's bizarre. He's totally given up. So here we've got this empire that just a few decades before was mowing down all of their neighbors and has been completely transformed into this paper tiger, this shadow of itself. And I think that that really fits the imagery of what's being communicated here in Daniel chapter 7. All right. Oh, yep, transformation from beast to man. Okay. I wanted to put this picture up here because I think this might give us a little bit of archaeological connection to the prophecy. The Babylonian Empire was associated with lions. Durant, in his book, Our Oriental Heritage, writes this: "Connecting the multitude of Babylonian temples ran a street called the Sacred Way. Its walls were lined with colored tiles, on which were 120 brightly enameled lions in low relief." These are the lions that Durant's talking about right here. They've excavated those, and I think this one sits in the Louvre in Paris. I can't remember off the top of my head. Either that or the British Museum, one of the two. I think the Ishtar Gate sits in the British Museum. I think this one sits in the Louvre in Paris. This is from the Sacred Way. This is exactly what Durant was talking about. You've got these lions lining the way along this street. The entrance to Nebuchadnezzar's palace was also guarded by gigantic basalt lions. And as I mentioned, we see this nation transform from the fierce lion into the weak beast. Let me read to you just a couple of quotations here from outside sources, just to corroborate what I am suggesting to you this evening. One historian writes, under Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian Empire recorded military victory after military victory. When Egypt conspired with Assyria to reduce Babylon to vassalage again, Nebuchadnezzar met the Egyptian hordes at Carchemish on the upper reaches of the Euphrates and almost annihilated them. That's the fierceness, the ferociousness of the Babylonians. Later on, that same historian writes, the once great military might of Babylon fell with Nebuchadnezzar. After his death, the army fell into disorder. Businessmen forgot love of country and the sublime internationalism of finance. The people busy with trade and pleasure unlearned the art of war. So here we've got the beast transformed into a man, a weak man. Now I'll pause and ask any questions or comments down through chapter 7, verse 4. And if you're thinking to yourself, how's he going to get through the book at this rate? You're thinking real well, because I don't know, quite frankly. 4 verses and 30 minutes. How about that? Any questions or comments? Yeah, Don, go ahead. Daniel was in captivity in Babylon beginning in 606 B.C. And the latest parts of Daniel appear to be written around 536 B.C., which was the third year of Cyrus the Great, king of Persia. He was there for the full 70 years of captivity that Jeremiah had predicted. And it's really interesting, in Daniel chapter 9, which we'll get to perhaps in a couple nights, in Daniel chapter 9, he's talking about reading Jeremiah, and he realizes that the time, the 70 years, has almost expired. And that's when he begins praying to God and asking God for forgiveness on behalf of his nation. It's a really beautiful chapter. So, yeah, 606 to 536 is when Daniel had these visions, and I believe recorded the visions for our benefit. Other questions or comments? Yeah, Marty, go right ahead. Oh, okay. Yep, thank you. Don asked when Daniel wrote these things. That was the question. All right. Any other questions or comments? Okay, let's get into verse number 5. Which I believe represents Persia. We've already had this succession set up in chapter 2. Let's go ahead and reread verse 5. And suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. All right, so let's take just a moment to talk about the symbolism. Daniel compares this beast to a bear. When you think of a bear, a lot of images might come to mind. Maybe you have the image of a bear with a tutu riding a unicycle. Maybe that's the image that comes to your mind. I don't know. I typically think of like a grizzly bear, right? That's what I think of, a ferocious beast. But also, a bear is fierce, but can be fierce in an almost blind, senseless way. And you think of a bear as just sort of overwhelming its prey, or overwhelming its enemy. Overwhelming aggression, particularly when it's provoked. In the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 17, verse 8, Hushai says this, for you know your father and his men, that they are mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. And your father is a man of war and will not camp with the people. That's, I think, the sense that I get of a bear. Overwhelming aggressiveness, senseless, almost out of its mind with rage. We also notice that the bear is raised up on one side, which means that one half of it is elevated above the other. There are three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, which means it's feasting on a fresh kill. And it's told to arise, devour much flesh, which means its killing is not done. It's already done some killing, and it's told to do some more killing. In chapter 2, we see the Babylonians succeeded by the Persians. How do the Persians compare to a bear? The Persians sought to win their battles not through brilliant military strategy, but through seeking to overwhelm their enemies with vast numbers. Now, some of the numbers I'm going to give to you are just going to seem just incredible, but this is what history has left us. The whole mass, this is a description of the Persian army, describing Xerxes and his invasion of Greece in 481 BC. The whole mass, though vast in number and amounting in the expedition of Xerxes to 1.8 million men, never achieved unity, and at the first sign of a reverse, it became a disorderly mob. It conquered by mere force of numbers, by an elastic capacity for absorbing casualties. Well, that's interesting. Xerxes had 1.8 million men. Durant says when they started to lose a battle, they became this like disorderly mob as they were retreating. He says that they conquered by force of numbers, which is quite different than men like Alexander the Great, who used brilliant military strategy to defeat his enemies. The Persians were not like that at all. Let's talk just a little bit more about that invasion of Greece. So Xerxes entered Greece in 41 BC. He did so with nearly 2 million soldiers. Resistance on the part of the Greeks seemed insane. The loyal states of Greece could not muster one-tenth of Xerxes' force. For 300 days, and some of you are very familiar with this story, the 300 Spartans under King Leonidas held the narrow pass of Thermopylae against the Persian army. Two Greeks survived, but they killed 20,000 Persians in the process. That's a 2 million man army going up against a 300-man force. Now, given they had that little choke period or choke place they were trying to get through, that little pass there, so the Greeks had the strategic advantage. But over the course of 2 days, the Greeks lost 298 men, and the Persians lost 20,000. It just gives you a sense. They're just trying to overwhelm people with numbers. There's not really any sort of strategy involved whatsoever. Following his victory over the Spartans, the Persian army poured into the Greek mainland. Meanwhile, a significant portion of its navy, some 200 to 600 ships, was destroyed by an inferior Greek navy in the Bay of Salamis. That's something. So you've got this navy, huge navy. You got to take a lot of ships to get 2 million men across that sea to invade Greece. And they lost 200 to 600 ships to a smaller, far inferior Greek navy in that particular battle. In humiliation over this, Xerxes retreated back to Sardis. He leaves behind 300,000 troops under the general Mardonius. After a year, 110,000 Greeks meet the Persian army at Plataea and overwhelmingly defeated the numerically superior force. And this just sort of begins Persia's reputation for monumental military defeats. They're like a bear. They're just trying to overwhelm their enemy with more numbers. It's sort of like the Allied strategy on D-Day. Let's throw so many men at that beach that the Germans are going to run out of bullets. That was the strategy, believe it or not. It's cruel, but that's what they were endeavoring to do. And that was sort of the philosophy of the Persian army. Let's just throw so many people at them that they can't beat us. Well, it did not work in their favor at all. They lost monumental battle after monumental battle. We also notice here that the bear is raised up on one side. Now remember, we have two nations that make up this single empire. We talked last night about the arms flowing into the chest, one arm representative of the Medes, one arm representative of the Persians, flowing into a single chest, signifying their unity. Here, though, we see the bear raised up on one side, which means that one side is higher or superior or elevated above the other side. And I think this alludes to the Persian superiority over the Medes. And whenever I talk about this particular empire, I'm going to almost invariably refer to them as the Persians. The Medes were important early on, but they were only the primary nation for just a short period of time. They fell by the wayside rather quickly. So it's raised up on one side, which shows the Persian superiority. We also see that there are three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. Now, this is a little bit of conjecture here, but I'm going to suggest to you that perhaps each of those ribs represents a fresh kill. Each of those ribs represents a fresh nation being taken down. I'm going to suggest to you that the Persians overtaking the Medes, the Lydians, and the Babylonians cemented their position as the next great world empire. That's what history bears out, and I think that that may be what is indicated by the three ribs in its mouth. And then the bear is told to arise, devour much flesh, which means that Persia would rule over a great many nations, and in fact, Persia would rule over the greatest expanse of territory, more so than any nation that had preceded it. Let me read to you a quotation here from a historian about this. Darius, who came a couple of emperors after Cyrus, Darius succeeded Cambyses, who was the son of Cyrus the Great, and expanded the borders of the Persian army to their greatest extent. Under Darius, the Persian Empire included 20 provinces, embracing Egypt, Palestine, Syria, Phoenicia, Lydia, Phrygia, Ionia, Cappadocia, Cilicia, Armenia, Assyria, the Caucasus, Babylonia, Media, Persia, the modern Afghanistan and Pakistan, India, west of the Indus. Never before had history recorded so extensive an area brought under one government. That is basically a territory that roughly stretches from modern-day Turkey all the way over into India and down into Egypt. This is a vast territory, and also up north, up into Armenia and the Caucasus, which would be north of modern-day Syria and Iraq. In between, I think it's the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, if memory serves me correct, that area up there. This is a vast territory. So when he is told to arise, devour much flesh, that's exactly what Persia did. They got rid of the Medes, they got rid of the Lydians, they got rid of the Babylonians. As soon as their empire was secured, they began expanding, and they expanded farther than any nation before them. As we talked about last night, Persia is followed by the Greeks, but I want to pause and ask any questions or comments down through verse number 5. I moved a little quicker on that one. All right, let's get into verse number 6 then, Greece. Daniel says, "After this I looked, and there was another, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it." All right, so here's our symbolism. This beast is like a leopard, which when you think of a leopard, what do you think of? Fast, real fast, right? Real fast. And if you put four wings of a bird on a leopard, what's that going to do to the leopard's speed? Yeah, it's going to make it go real quick, isn't it? All right? We've increased the speed of one of the fastest animals on the face of the earth. This leopard has four heads. It's got four heads but one body. And what I think this represents, and history bears this out, is that we have a single kingdom that has been split between four different rulers. And what I mean by that, I'll talk about here in just a moment. So we've got this very fast animal that's made faster by its wings. We have a kingdom that is split into four parts, four different heads, four different rulers. How does this fit the Greeks? Well, under Alexander the Great, the Greeks conquered with amazing speed. The ideal of a quick, decisive victory was bred into the Greeks was bred into the Greek armies from the earliest times. Keegan, in his History of Warfare, writes this: "The lifeblood of the Greek city-states was agriculture. Consequently, at least 80% of those we call citizens of the city-states were countrymen and not town dwellers, which means the vast majority of Greek soldiers were farmers. Given the extreme brevity of time in which attack could be made effective in the Greek farming world." So you have to imagine here, you've got to squeeze in these wars in between, harvesting and planting, probably. Or maybe between planting and harvesting. I don't know how Greek agriculture worked back then, but I mean, you got a pretty small window of time here. Okay? Given the extreme brevity of the time in which an attack could be made effective in the Greek farming world, and given also that the attackers left their own fields vulnerable to spoliation when they marched off to campaign, the highest premium was placed, or placed itself, in settling matters as quickly and decisively as possible. You see, the speed with which Alexander struck was not just simply Alexander the Great pushing his army. This was bred into the Greek soldier. Now, he took his army on a campaign across over into India. So these weren't a bunch of farmers. These were professional soldiers. But I think that this quotation emphasizes the DNA of the Greek soldier. They were trained, they were bred to strike quickly, and make these battles short and sweet, so to speak. When Alexander the Great set out from Greece in 334, he was 21 years old. By the age of 29, Alexander stood atop the world as its greatest conqueror. As I mentioned last night in chapter 2, Alexander conquered from Asia Minor to India. He conquered the territorial equivalent of the Persian kings Cyrus, Cambyses, and Darius all put together. It took them 60 years to conquer that territory. He did it in 8. Now that's speed. That is speed. That's why the Greeks are represented like a leopard with 4 wings of a bird. All right, we also have 4 heads. And what that represents is how the empire was divided into 4 pieces upon the death of Alexander. On his deathbed, when his generals asked him to whom he left the empire, Alexander said this, "To the strongest. I'm leaving it to the strongest." Now you say that to a bunch of generals, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to think they're the strongest, right? And they're going to fight with anybody who disagrees with them. As one might imagine, Alexander's generals could not reach a clear consensus on who was the strongest. And attempts to unite the kingdom under one throne after Alexander's death were met with dissension and rebellion, which ended after a period of about 20 years at the Battle of Ipsus. And following that battle, the territory that Alexander had conquered was divided between 4 of his generals, between Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. Those last two are going to become really important if we get to chapter 8 in the next couple of nights. Seleucus and Ptolemy are going to play a very prominent role in the history of the Jewish people between Malachi and Matthew. And those two generals and the territory they ruled went right in the middle of modern-day Israel, Palestine. So there was a lot of tugging back and forth over the territory of Israel. So the 4 heads represent how this one empire was divided among 4 generals. The kingdom conquered swiftly, but as we talked about last night, it was inferior to the Persians because it just sort of fizzed out after the death of Alexander. I'll pause here. Any questions or comments up through verse number 6? I'm starting to move a little faster. Yeah. Cassander. That's Cassander. Lysimachus, Lysi, Machus, Lysi, Machus, Seleucus, Seleucus. I'll say that one more time. Seleucus, Seleucus. S. And Ptolemy, 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 Cassander, Lysimachus, Seleucus, and Ptolemy. These were the four generals that divided Alexander's empire after the Battle of Ipsus. Any other questions or comments? Three ribs, the Medes, the Lydians, and the Babylonians. Medes, Lydians would be Lydians, and the Babylonians. And as I said, that's a bit of conjecture, but history does make it clear that once those three nations were conquered, the Persians' supremacy was solidified, and they became the big kid on the block, so to speak, once they had conquered the Medes, the Lydians, and the Babylonians. Other questions or comments? All right. All right, let's get just a little bit into the symbolism here in verse number 7. I won't be able to talk about the fourth beast in detail this evening, but we'll at least get through some of the symbolism. Verse 7. After this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. So, let's talk about this symbolic language. It was dreadful and terrible and exceedingly strong. Notice that Daniel does not give us a likeness with this beast. Babylon was like a lion. Persia was like a bear. Greece was like a leopard. There is no likeness. There is no comparison drawn between this beast and anything on earth. And I think that that's on purpose. I don't think that there is a comparison that Daniel could draw. All right? It's dreadful, it's terrible, it's exceedingly strong. It has teeth of iron, and when you see that metal iron, if you were here last night, what does that make you think of? Rome, right? Rome was represented by the legs of iron and the feet of iron mixed with clay. So it had teeth of iron. Its teeth, of course, represent a consuming, a viciousness. It has 10 horns, and we're told that those horns represent 10 kings. We're told that in verse number 24. That's one of those really helpful moments where God gives us the interpretation of what something means. It seems to me, based upon the succession of empires that we have established in chapter 2 and what we've seen thus far in chapter 7, that we can safely conclude that this beast represents Rome. And as we look at some of the descriptions of the Roman military might tomorrow night, I think we will all see that Rome was indeed dreadful and terrible. They were known for this. They were known for their cruelty and their avarice. And I think the beast that's described here is very fitting of that nation. Any questions or comments as we draw to a close for this evening? Well, God willing, then we'll pick up in verse number 7 tomorrow night.